You're listening to Root Cause Remedies, a show that explores environmental justice from right here in Hawaii. I'm Tina Grandinetti, and I'll be your humble host and fellow traveler on this huaka'i to learn more about the issues that affect the lands, waters, and people that sustain us. Back in June, which seems simultaneously like yesterday and 1,000 years ago, thanks but no thanks pandemic, Sierra Magazine published an article called Racism is Killing the Planet, in which the author Hop Hopkins argues that the ideology of white supremacy is fueling our climate crisis, and basically that we will never solve climate change if we don't tackle white supremacy head on. He writes, "You can't have climate change without sacrifice zones, and you can't have sacrifice zones without disposable people, and you can't have disposable people without racism." The article went pretty viral because for some people, namely Black, Indigenous, and people of color, it was speaking this truth that we knew already from lived experience and from generations of trauma, dispossession, resistance, and of course survival. But it also went viral because some people couldn't stomach it. You know, that whole, why are you making this a race issue type of thing. So we thought we'd dedicate an episode to exploring the intersections of environmental justice and racial justice. And how could we not? You know, the United States is in the middle of this historic uprising for racial justice. In the last few months, people fighting for an end to police violence against Black folks have literally been run down by cars, shot and murdered, sprayed with tear gas, maimed with rubber bullets, and arrested by police in unmarked vehicles. People are putting their bodies on the line for racial justice, for real. They're demanding the abolition of the police and prison system, and most incredibly, they're actually winning huge victories despite this brutal repression. To honor that struggle, this tremendous uprising that we are witnessing, we're calling this episode White Supremacy is Killing Us, and we're talking with Joy Enomoto. She's a Black Kanaka scholar, activist, artist, educator. I don't know, what isn't this woman? She's like everything. She's the author of another viral article called Why Black Lives Matter in the Hawaiian Kingdom. And if you were at the Black Lives Matter rally that drew 10,000 plus people to the state capitol, you may have heard her give a mic drop speech about the same topic. She really has this powerful ability to draw from her own identity, her own genealogy, probably like directly from her ancestors, to fulfill this heavy but important and really special kuleana to educate people about the ways that every form of oppression is interconnected, and so every kind of liberation is interconnected. To borrow her words, she always says, my liberation requires your liberation. I cannot be free until we are all free. In this conversation, we got kind of personal. We spent most of the time exploring Joy's roots in the movement. And it's really telling that her personal story of political awakening and consciousness raising and activation really moves across the issues of racial justice and environmental justice so organically, because they're not separate, right? They're deeply intertwined. So we talk about anti-Blackness, aloha aina, prison abolition, organizing, so many different things. You're in for a real treat and some major, major truth bombs. Can you tell us a little bit about your roots and how they ground you in the work that you do?
Yeah, sure. So my father is from Maui and my mother is from Texas, and they met in California, and I was born in California. And my father is Hawaiian, Scottish, Japanese. My mom is African-American and Cato Indian and Sikh. And which is a really crazy intersectional existence already. But I didn't really get politicized until I went to Berkeley. I went to school at Berkeley and had all these amazing, I was just surrounded by all these amazing activists and like radical professors. But my real awakening was when I joined an organization called STORM, which was Standing Together to Organize a Revolutionary Movement. And we started looking at police violence in San Francisco and the Bay Area. And one of my sort of introductions into police, like dealing with police brutality, besides Rodney King, Rodney King happened in 93. And the entire, all of California was shut down under a curfew. And so it was like being under this very strange martial law because the police beat up a black man and it was on video. And then they get off innocently, right? Then they get acquitted, even though we're like, okay, here's all the proof, here's the data. So it was like the riots of my time, so to speak. So that kind of started opening my eyes to police violence in a systemic way. I think I'd always seen police violence, but I wasn't really thinking about it systemically and the levels of innocence. And then a man named Aaron Williams gets killed by the San Francisco Police Department with pepper spray. Pepper spray was a new weapon at that time being utilized by the police. And he wasn't given water and proper, he wasn't treated the way he was supposed to be treated. And they called it sudden in custody death syndrome, which was like, that's another way of saying you died by the police. And he died because he couldn't breathe. It was, he asphyxiated to death. Then, Van Jones was in that organization at the time, and he was able to get the officer that killed Aaron Williams arrested. I mean, not arrested, but fired, which was the first time a San Francisco police officer had ever been fired for killing someone. So that was a major milestone. But you started seeing, like, this is like the Clinton era. So you just start seeing this rise in like three strikes, you're out. You start seeing this incredible heavy move towards criminalization of youth. And so, I mean, that's kind of how I kind of, in a weird way, got jumped into dealing with police brutality and police accountability. And then I started working in the late 90s with Critical Resistance. That was started by Angela Davis and some other prison abolitionists, and really looked at the entire carceral state. So, you know, as I was developing, I was really beginning to understand the highest levels of carceral injustice that we were living under a police state almost all the time if you were a person of color. And at the same time, I was also noticing all of this environmental racism that was happening, that the poorest communities tended to have the recycling centers. They tended to have the light industry that had a lot of heavy metal pollutions, particularly in places like West Oakland, where I was living at the time. And I was also working for a city council member for a while. They wouldn't even get it. They wouldn't give them a grocery store, but they had BART running through the middle of it. They had all kinds of pollution. They had lots of neighborhood blight because people couldn't afford to maintain their homes because a lot of people were being arrested. It was an older community. So you took a community that basically had come out of the civil rights movement and people move a lot, sort of a black community that was moving westward for work at the harbor, right? Like longshoremen and things like that. Being divided and split and marginalized for years, for decades, particularly after the rise of Black Panthers, right? You start seeing just this very unspoken redlining happening around places like West Oakland or East Oakland. And these working Black communities were incredibly policed. Like they're just super, like we would hear police helicopters every night, but they didn't have a grocery store, you know? So we're seeing that the link between kind of like making neighborhoods like mini jails or neighborhood like community prisons without proper economic support. And also with high levels of pollution, you had really high rates of cancer. You had high rates of asthma among children there. There was, you know, and you combine that with all, you know, with regular sort of the violence that was coming out of the war on drugs and the flooding of neighborhoods with drugs, right? So it was kind of like the more I started getting politicized, the more I couldn't, you can't ignore the intersections between capitalism, like sort of a rising militarized police state and environmental racism, environmental injustice, right? That the poorest communities have the most police, but the fewest resources.
It sounds like your political awakening happened in the U.S. on the continent. What did moving back or moving to Hawaii have, like, what did it contribute to your analysis?
When I went to live on Maui, I was completely burnt out. Mm. Had dealt with patriarchy in movement building. I had been like assaulted twice, and I was really needing to ground myself. But more importantly is that somewhere in that time I met Haunani K. Trask. She gave this most amazing intersectional, internationalist speech to connect sort of Black liberation struggles and like global liberation struggles to the Hawaiian sovereignty movement. And I had never heard anyone do that before. I told her that I was Hawaiian, and she was like, I don't even know what are you doing here? She's like, you have work to do. What are you doing? Go. You need to go to Hawaii. Right. And that stayed with me. You know, I didn't do it like the next day, but it stayed with me so much that I was like, she's right. Like, what am I doing here? There's work that I have to do. And then I was kind of getting different ancestral signals of like, there's work that you need to do on your ancestral land. I had gone to Cuba as well. And in Cuba, I started having these crazy ancestral dreams. And so there was a lot of things leading me back to Hawaii. But I also just needed to ground myself back in our family land, like a family, kind of like a family homestead. Is it like between Makoa and Paia on Baldwin Avenue on Maui? And we have a family graveyard there. And like, I needed to just reconnect with my family. While I was there, I became a carpenter and was realizing like what carpenters are being asked to build. So on the one hand, I was like, I really want to learn this trade. You know, I really want to learn I really want to know how to build a house. And on the other hand, I was like, well, what I'm actually building for the most part is hotels for foreigners. Wow. Out of foreign desire. I ended up working for a program called Being Empowered and Safe Together, which is a prisoner reintegration program. I was trying, like in a weird way, I was definitely trying to like give myself a break from it, and I did, but there was always this thing calling me back, you know, more critically conscious work. So when I started doing that work, that was really life-changing, because that's where I really saw like the majority of prisoners were Hawaiian. I was working with folks who had been incarcerated for 5 or more years, which means they had gone in for serious crimes, whether it was armed robbery or murder or rape or something really serious. So some people were lifers that were out on parole. Other people were folks who were coming out after being in prison for like 20 years, 15 years. 90% of them were Hawaiian. Many of them had been sent to Arizona. And some had even been in Oklahoma before that, when they had the SHU in Oklahoma, but that got shut down because of how terrible the conditions were. Mm-hmm. And how violent they were toward their prisoners. And so I was dealing with these guys coming out. And I also met family members that I had not known as I was growing up, coming out. And what was great about that program was that it was a completely comprehensive reintegration program that was rooted in Hawaiian values. So we actually, for their part of the work release program, we were able to take the clients to Hawaiian archaeological sites, take them to Lo'i. We had a family reunification program. We had a halau inside. I was also doing cognitive re-education, which means like, which is a really fancy way of saying, how do you help people think, change their behavior as they come out? But one of the main things that I learned in that, every single day that our prisoners are inside, they're being told that they are criminals, that they're addicts, that they're nothing, that they're numbers, that they don't have a name, that they're always going to be that. And that's coming from the prison guards, right? That's coming from the society around them, right? Or the lack of society around them. When I went in to teach, I first said, your anger at the state is validated. So, and then the second thing that I said was, you are not your crimes. So if now that you know that you are not your crimes, who are you? And they were like, no one has ever, no matter how many cognitive specialists or whatever they've had come in there, have ever asked them that question.
Yeah.
And they were like, that's actually a really hard question. Right. And so I realized that no one was really asking them. They were just started being told what to regurgitate and how their behavior needed to change. Just that simple question of who are you? I saw men break down in ways that I haven't seen them break down, like a lot of their bravado kind of. And like I watched like big, like solid, you know, tattooed brothers like talking about, well, my parents got divorced at 5 and it really hurt me. I was like, what? You know, but when you see that kind of vulnerability, even when I was a carpenter, even in these highly like chauvinistic, patriarchal kind of workplaces, when men are kind of left alone or when they're kind of left to their own devices, they will reveal a vulnerability that you may not get to see otherwise, and it provides an opportunity to engage in larger questions. You know, because I was in a job where I had to convince, you know, the community that as these men are coming out, that they were worthy of a job and housing or whatever. And like one of the great things about the program too, we did step down rental. Like, so we would pay the first month's rent and then we would step down by like $100 for like 6 months. So the client got on their feet. We helped them get their driver's license back. We helped pay old fines that were still accruing while they were inside. Just all kinds of things that people don't even think that prisoners need as they're reintegrating. But the main thing was convincing people that they've done their time. Yeah. And at what point do we say they've done their time and they cease to be, right? They've paid their debt. So, and some of my clients have really gone on to have amazing lives, get married, have children, and do tremendous work toward healing the harm they've caused, because we did a lot of restorative justice as well. While other clients I've had, they were about to come off of parole and they started using again just because they were so afraid of the idea of not being supervised anymore.
Wow.
And that was also really like, it was like the cop in their head. There's all these little moments of realizing how Hawaiians have been put in this place and how limited our labor options are in Hawaii, how limited our choices are. And if you can't leave, if you're not allowed to like leave Hawaii to find like a wider range of work, a lot of folks get caught up in like, they have low wage jobs. They don't feel like they have anything really worth, you know, fighting for in a sense.
Yeah. I know you as a demilitarization activist. And I also know you as somebody who has like been really active in, you know, the fight for Black lives in Hawaii, but I didn't know all of that history. So maybe you can tell me a little bit about the joy that I'm more familiar with, like how you became active old joy in the fight for demilitarization. And yeah, what was that? How did that come about?
When we moved to Oahu, I was like made immediately aware of how militarized Oahu itself is, right? You're talking about overall in Hawaii, it's like the military has 25% of the landmass, but the presence of the military is most profound on Oahu, meaning like there's Pearl Harbor, like there's nowhere I go where people are not, there isn't a visible presence of the military. And these are things that I was not that familiar. Like I just had not lived that close to the military. And it really, there was also high levels of military, you know, like sexual violence being associated with the military. There's environmental pollution associated with the military, meaning that they're like all these live fire ranges that like all of these, you know, all of these unexploded, you know, all these shrapnel, all these things that they say they're cleaning, but they're shooting into conservation zones. There's just these high levels of brownfields that are being left by them, and just through like Navy games like RIMPAC, they're coming onto land and with amphibious, you know, vehicles, and you know, there's all this constant environmental detriment happening through the military. There's a constant sound of military helicopters going over all the time. There's ospreys that are losing parts and crashing into the beach, right? There's just so many issues, right? But I didn't really start paying attention to DMIL work until I met Kyle Kajihiro and got to work with Auntie Terry and go on a detour, like, and learn about their detours and the real work that they were doing. And then I went to Guam in 2016 and to see a place that's so much smaller than Hawaii, so occupied by the military. Like, they were just, I mean, everything was the military. And still within that, there's this Chamorro independence fight. And there was still so much, the reefs were still intact, which blew my mind, because in Hawaii, like, all the reefs were blown out in Waikiki and in Pearl Harbor, like, because of the military. It was a real awakening as to what a militarized, occupied island nation looked like. And then from there, we went to Okinawa in 2017, which was like from with probably the biggest blast of DMIL. But thinking about demilitarization, like, I think my step into demilitarization really started into wanting to demilitarize the police. Right. So it really began in those early days, but I just didn't know. Like, San Francisco used to have Fleet Week and you'd have like thousands of sailors coming in, and I never, it didn't really occur to me. But, you know, you also had things like Bayview's Hunter Point, where the ships that were used in nuclear testing were taken from the Marshals and brought to San Francisco Bay to be cleaned. And that's Hunter's Point. And in Hunter's Point, it's predominantly Black and Pacific Islander communities. Right. So there's this massive nuclear brownfield right in the heart of San Francisco.
And it stretches, really, it's like connected to islands in the Pacific, even though so far away.
So
and
that
then still affecting like people of color.
Exactly. And only really predominantly people of color, right? Because pretty much like the white folks that lived there had moved out.
Right.
It became public housing. And like the cancer rates, the the kind of random illnesses that are associated with Hunter's Point, and it's an incredibly poor community, right? It was just, it was not a coincidence, right? So I'm looking at these links between the military, environmental damage, and poor communities and working poor communities. So, you know, we there's real links to military damaging a place, like damaging the environment, and then trying to move poor people, particularly communities of color, into those spaces. Right. And then denying that the links to massive illnesses, particularly rises in cancer and other unusual illnesses, they deny that there's any link. I was like, it's funny because every time you guys do this, there's a link to cancer. Right. Hawaii also has incredibly high cancer rates, particularly breast cancer rates. Right. That can be tied to the chemicals that were used in the plantations, on the sugar plantations. But it, but where are those sugar plantations getting their chemicals from, right? We're also like, how is it not tied to World War II when the all of Hawaii was under martial law, right? So many trees and so many things were ripped out for the sake of the military, you know? So there's these massive links. Right. And so that's kind of how I really got into to DMIL. And I've just progressively gotten more and more involved in it. I guess even if you I go back to like thinking about Ko'olawe, right? I was just a little kid when Ko'olawe was jumping off, but I remember it as this really big milestone, you know, for Hawaiian victories. And I remember as a kid, I was like, oh my God, they're like actually on an island that's being bought. Like they're at, and my father used to tell me that when he was a kid, like when he was growing up, he could just, he remembers just hearing the island being bombed and it would shake their house. And they live in Makawao up on Haleakala, right? You know, I mean, they're living really far away, mm-hmm. relatively speaking, to that island. So if it's shaking their house, that's how many bombs, right? Like that my father's familiar with. He was born on December 6, 1940. So he was one when World War II mm-hmm. happened. Like his connection to war and being in a militarized, occupied Hawaii is very intimate for him.
Yeah.
Right. His father was sent to, had to join the military because he was Japanese Hawaiian. So it denies him his Hawaiian side, but because he was Japanese, he immediately had to go prove his loyalty to the United States. My grandfather's brother was kidnapped by the U.S. Navy because he had a ham radio. So, and it was stronger than the Navy's at the time. So he was literally kidnapped and they commandeered his radio. And he didn't get honored for that till like, I don't know, like the late 1970s, you know, early 1980s. And then there's Vietnam and there's all these different things that have had these detrimental of impact on my family, on many Hawaiian families. Yeah. And it has far-reaching implications in that, you know, we have family members that have PTSD and maybe they end up becoming cops or maybe, but like there's all this unresolved kind of pain. And then that plays out among families. So it's not really a question as to how Hawaii looks the way that it looks right now and how damaged we are as Kanaka in many ways.
I feel like on Oahu, when you're growing up, It took me a while to even notice that. So then you talking about moving here from Maui and that becoming so clear really makes me think of how much we normalize it and it becomes invisible in our lives here. But I guess one thing I want to ask is I think of you as an aloha aina, and I think one part of your story that I'm curious about is when aina became such a central part of the work that you do and what you fight for.
Oh, that's easy. So when I was working for the BEST program and we were going to Lo'i just to work with the aina, with these guys that were, you know, getting to reunite with their families on the aina. And we were all growing food together. And then there was because our family land is like ag land. I decided to plant, you know, some kalo on our family land. And that was like the first time that I'd actually done it. Nothing connected me more than actually going every day to take care of our own family, like little kalo batch. Mm-hmm. And looking at how far away I had come from the aina, that need to feel soil and to reconnect really was the grounding point for me, because I felt more close to all of my ancestors that had lived there and had gardens and had tended food there and raised pigs and all kinds of stuff. You know, going from Maui where it was pretty much still ag at that time, right? Like you still didn't have the same amount of development, to here was like a lot, you know. So, but I realized like the news that you get on Maui about Oahu is almost entirely all criminal, right? It's this idea that the urban Hawaiian is a violent criminal.
Wow.
There's always these manhunts for the cop killer or for whatever, right? But then when a white guy kills somebody, then they're like, well, who is this man? And like, what's his mental health issues, right? Like the guy that in January, you know, he stabs his landlord.
Oh, the fires.
Yeah. He sets 7 houses on fire. Like he shoots these 2 local cops. Rather than really call, like, rather than say like, this guy is a murderer, they're like, who is this man? What's the mental health issues? And not that we shouldn't be looking at mental health for everyone here, but I'm like, and I'm really noticing this in the media so much more, is that the first thing that we'll do with a Kanaka is talk about their criminal past, is talk about why killing them, killing us, mm-hmm. why shooting at us or imprisoning us is always justified. But when you pay attention to aina, you really start to pay attention to a lot of things,
yeah.
right? I think being grounded in aina helps you see everything.
Well, I think some of what you're saying loops right back around to your speech at the Black Lives Matter rally last month. You wove all these connections between anti-blackness and white supremacy and colonialism and the military occupation of Hawaii. I guess what I want to ask, which isn't really a fair question, is what's the connection there between anti-blackness and police violence and then Aina? You know, what was interesting about that rally was I had a lot of friends who had never been to a protest before. They had never been to any of the massive Aloha Aina marches and or anything. They'd never been to the Mauna, but they felt called to go to the Black Lives Matter rally, which is great. You know, like any way you enter into a movement for justice and liberation is amazing. But I feel like I want to help them see the connection between that call for justice and the one that Kanaka are engaged with all over the islands, like in so many different communities. So maybe you can kind of help explain that for our audience.
Hawaii is particularly complicated, but it's not. The police are sent to protect property. That's what their role is. Their role is to protect property and property owners. And that is rooted in white supremacy. Because in order for that to happen, you have to have someone that's always slated as a criminal. In most of America, that's indigenous people and that's black folks, right? Mm-hmm. So when you have a country that was founded on the genocide of indigenous people and then put in its place a replacement population of slaves to do the work, Robin G. Kelly said, annexation and slavery go hand in hand, right? So you're seeing as the U.S. is spreading itself across the West, it's killing and annexing, and it's using the police to protect the property of people that just killed someone to take their land. Mm. I mean, it's really that blunt and grotesque. Hawaii is different because it was a sovereign nation that had the audacity to stand up to the United States, right? They were like, and even to stand up to Britain and to, you know, to other countries, you know. In a sense, we were discovered late, right? Cook didn't find us. He didn't get here for another century compared to the other parts of the Pacific. So we're a much more established nation, or kingdom, I should say, or constitutional monarchy, right? What you do see is an influx of foreign influence in ideas around property and criminalization, right? So, there's also influence coming from missionaries, right? When you look at early laws that are coming out of like 1827, Kahuana was a Christian, right? So, there's like the laws actually kind of mimic the Bible in this weird way, right? It's like, thou shalt not kill, you know, like no adultery, all these kinds of things. But the real link for today is the way that we saw Kalakaua and Queen Liliuokalani and a lot of our Hawaiian monarchs, they were characterized as black people, right? Mm-hmm. The biggest insult they were trying to give them was to compare them to the worst grotesque stereotypes of black people, right? Right. So there is this constant trying to link Hawaiians to blackness and savagery and to subjugate, to justify the overthrow, right? These were not real people. These were actual animals that we overthrew. They were not equipped to run their own country. It didn't matter that we ran it for centuries. It didn't matter that we let them into our kingdom. What we see is also when Kamehameha Schools becomes a military institution and you see this rise of eugenics in Hawaii, there's more and more anti-blackness seeping into the kingdom after the overthrow. Mm. And where there's a lack of actual, like, high numbers of black people, because Hawaiians had blocked slavery in 1852, thanks to Alexander Liholiho and Prince Laud and Kaua Keoli, that was in the Constitution. So they had to figure out, they had to make different moves. But the idea of slave labor always loomed over Hawaii in terms of plantations. Plantations were run by the same sugar barons that ran the South. Mm-hmm. The plantation
the plantations were divided into racial hierarchies, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, why were the Japanese at the top of this, right? Chinese had been there, but then they kind of left. They didn't stay long in the plantation as much. But there was always this push going on to have labor come in, not from Japan, actually. The white, like a lot of the folks within the cabinet were like trying to be like, no, let's get Indian labor. There was even a push for white labor, like German labor. It was really interesting stuff, right? For today, right? So why do people not make these connections to Hawaiian sovereignty or these other moves? Is because Hawaiians have been assumed to be just angry, right? We're just assumed to be criminals and angry, and we don't have jobs and we don't have anything better to do, right? But and our murders are almost made invisible. When there's really 30 murders, you know, the HPD will report 20, right? So it's like we've been seeing this underreported use of violence by the police in Hawaii. Why Black Lives Matter kicks off particularly right now for everybody else, I'm not quite sure. Maybe it was just the most blatant murder for a new generation to see, and it's starting to click with them that this is not a new idea. But sometimes it's easier to link onto an idea you feel is detached from you or further away than right next door to you.
Wow, yeah.
Right?
That's
It's complicated in that way, but quite frankly, when we were on the Mauna, we're protecting our aina against the interests of a corporation, multi-corporation, right, held up by all these different universities. And it's always slated as for the good of all humanity. Well, who are these guys to decide what's the good of all humanity? Right? I was like, when did that happen? But that's that kind of eminent domain. That's that kind of like white man's burden. That's kind of that big picture of like, we know what's good for you. But this is our aina, right? Mm-hmm. And what's hard is when you have a lot of settlers, one, a lot of folks who are descendants of the plantation do not want to see themselves as settlers because they're like, well, we built this and we were treated badly. And that's true. But with the way the plantation was set up in that kind of almost caste system was to make sure that there was always a division between plantation workers and Hawaiians. Mm-hmm. And so we were either labeled as weak, as criminal, or as lazy. And then when we didn't necessarily always want to quarantine for whatever new plague was coming through, we were seen as dirty. That's really rooted in white supremacy. But that was an idea that was seeping into the idea and being fed to all of the people of Hawaii, right? That there was this sort of, even though the U.S. is going to war with Japan, there was always this sort of admiration and romanticization of Japan. The Portuguese who come in, they think they're going to be lunas, and then they find out that they're only going to be workers. But then you also have Portuguese, like very long held traditions around anti-blackness coming in from Portuguese, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a lot of people coming into the kingdom with their own racialized ideas. It's like, how do you connect that for right now? It's because we were raised with white supremacy and didn't even know it half the time because everybody was brown.
Yeah.
In the kingdom, like there wasn't this issue with blackness. In fact, that was actually not a thing at all. But by the time you get to World War I and World War II, by the time of the overthrow, you've got these racialized ideas in the kingdom that, and there's these, you know, saying that black people are somehow not human or closer to being like monkeys, and Hawaiians are in a proximity to whiteness, right, which is always conditional. And we were, you know, and so different people were being given these different messages that blackness is associated with bad and whiteness is associated with good. Power is associated with whiteness and death and loss is associated with being darker, right? Or being indigenous or being black. It's the links are so long, right? And all of this was because the position of Hawaii, right? So it was for militarized purposes so they can, you know, control the Pacific, and it was to control the resources, right? So because sugar ends in the U.S., right? They want to end the tariffs that are happening in Hawaii, right? They take over the kingdom just so they can grow sugar and export it. So we're paying for the dessert economies, really, of America and Europe throughout the Pacific. that was a really long way to say that people now are starting to really realize, you know, coming out of COVID when everybody's got time on their hands and they're not working, right? They're seeing the cracks in capitalism. Mm-hmm. They're seeing the cracks in how our economy was really working. And then you're witnessing blatant murder by the state and saying, wait a minute, like, while all of us are on quarantine, you're going to like kill people?
Yeah. And you're right. It's about property. Like all of these deaths are related to like, I mean, some of them aren't related to anything at all. They're like almost completely random, but a lot of them are related to these like small infractions of like the rules around property, like a bad check or selling something where you're not supposed to. I feel like we see Hawaiians on the Mauna at Kalailoa being criminalized because they're asserting land as aina instead of property. Like,
right. They're always fighting a corporation, right? Mm-hmm. They're always fighting like windmills that are not allowed to be built anywhere else, mm-hmm. right? And there's Caldwell supporting it, right? And it's right behind a school. So if any of those windmills fall or break, they could actually kill children. There's environmental impacts to this so-called green action, right? And then Caldwell was, again, trying to push through a part where he knew there was Hawaiian bones. Mm-hmm. Where it was documented, and not even 2 hours into his digging, while we're all on COVID, like coming out to defend it in the middle of a pandemic, you know, they find bones within a couple of hours. I mean, like, come on. And then now he has to back out. Right now is like Black Lives Matter is rising. All of a sudden he's pulling out of it altogether. I was like, that's because you're not looking good, dude. You know, but all these moves, right? If you go back and look at any struggle in Hawaii, it's always tied to land. It is always tied to land.
And at the same time, we're being held up as criminals. As the United States is actually physically, illegally occupying our entire country, we're considered the violent ones. Yeah. We're considered the troublemakers, right? And then they use descendants of the plantation or other settlers to prop up their position to suppress the Hawaiian population, right? To suppress Kanakas, yeah. right? And then when wars come in, you're seeing also, so alliances that we would have had with Black folks under other circumstances, now you're coming, many Black folks are coming through as members of the military representing the country that is occupying us.
Yeah.
And so alliances are difficult there if you're on the other side of the gun. So then it becomes less important about whether or not you're Black, but more in what you're representing. But then we also know the kind of racism that goes on within the U.S. military. Mm-hmm. We also know that Black communities are given very limited options. We know that high school, like there's military recruiters in Black high schools in the same way that there's military recruiters in our high schools, right? So in places where you have limited labor options, you have this influx, right? We have tons of Hawaiians in the military. We have tons of Chamorros in the military. We have tons of, communities of color, like people throughout the Pacific Samoans in the military dying at these disproportionate rates for the U.S. to go out and do extractive colonialism, basically for U.S. interests abroad, right? So if the U.S., if the police are here to protect property within our borders, within the U.S. borders, the military is there to protect U.S. extraction abroad. Hawaii has got the double hit. And what really bugs people is that they never legally annexed us, right? So they know they're here illegally. And it's just we're this constant thorn in their side. So they're always trying to say, well, like Hawaiians are not clean. You know, like this idea that Hawaiians are like, well, they're all homeless, right? They don't care about their aina. I'm like, well, we're homeless because you took our land.
Mm-hmm. The occupation of Hawaii is an environmental justice issue. It's like the all time. If environmental justice is about power and, you know, like self-determination over what happens to land, U.S. get out.
Exactly. And I mean, when you think, really think about the sort of environmental devastation as we're dealing with climate change, right? And we're so worried about rising tides. They blew out our marshlands. They filled in our marshlands. They put in the Alawai Canal. This is in the 1920s and 30s, right? You devastate the entire Waikiki coastline, Kaka'ako coastline, right? You change the entire world for us, right? Where there was salt beds, where there was fishing, where there was marshlands. And you fill that in so that you can bring in your military warships. You blow out our reefs, right? So you're killing our food options. You're also killing
the natural things that are in place that would prevent climate change, that would prevent a lot of the damage that could come from rising tides and the bacteria, you know, like whenever there's a big storm and all the bacteria that comes up because they don't have proper sewage, all those things that were in place before in a natural way, the military comes in, corporations come in, and then displace Hawaiians from their ancestral lands where they've always been able to feed themselves.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, who's causing the environmental damage there? So it always goes hand in hand. It's like capital and military, capital and military. The five businessmen who overtook the kingdom could not have done that if they did not have the Marines lined up in front of the palace where they imprisoned our queen. I mean, that's some deep stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, I think I have two more questions. I'm comparing this to what I've learned about environmental justice, just like researching this podcast, that like this is a concept and a movement that was spearheaded by Black communities. It's came out of Black struggle. And then knowing that this friend who I have worked with for so long, like your story is, and I obviously knew you're Black, but I didn't know how deeply your story is rooted in Black liberation struggles on the continent. Knowing how indebted environmental justice is to Black communities, and then knowing how your own story comes out of movements for Black justice on the continent, like how is the history of Black resistance important here in Hawaii, and how can it help us build power here? Because I feel like we learn a lot of, if we're lucky, we get to learn a lot of Mo'olelo and histories about struggle that happened here, like for example in the 1970s, but we don't necessarily learn so much about the struggles happening being led by people of color in the U.S. aside from, you know, like Martin Luther King and stuff.
True. Well, I think people have gotten, they really are being they've gotten a little bit of amnesia and gotten a little ahistorical about what was actually happening in the 60s and 70s in Hawaii and who we were actually learning from. That's in the middle of Vietnam, right? This is in the middle of massive peace struggles that are happening around the world,
yep.
Right? So you have people like Honani K actually being trained and meeting with the Black Panthers, right? You have the Black Panthers coming into the Pacific and going to places like Australia and New Zealand to work with like the Polynesian Panthers. Mm-hmm. There's actually a whole Black power movement that rises up out of PNG, out of New Caledonia and in Fiji, right? Because that's a direct response to the Klan that had gotten set up in the Fiji, right? But in Hawaii, basically everyone was reading the Black Panthers during the 70s, right? And they are looking to, and they're also, I mean, it's not just, you know, they're not just looking at Black liberation struggles. They're also looking at AIM, right? Mm-hmm. This is the same time. They're looking at struggles around the world. And the idea that Hawaii has not always been globally connected to other liberation struggles is just ridiculously ahistoric. We are not known for rioting in the same way that other people is. And I think that's where people are like, well, Hawaii is more peaceful, we don't riot. I'm like, well, there's a lot of reasons for that. But let's not say that we haven't had massive uprisings or nor were we not influenced. I was like, the idea to go take over an island that's being actively bombed by the military, that's coming out of peace movements that are happening around the world, right? Against Vietnam, right? This is an anti-war movement,
right?
First and foremost. And there's a massive feminist, Pacific feminist conference that happened in 1971 in Suva, where women from all over the Pacific are coming and debating, you know, issues of peace in the Pacific and independence, right? The most radical are coming out of Melanesia because they're aligning themselves with the Pan-Africanist movement. But Hawaii is also there, right? Mm. That we are connected to looking at these rise in independence struggles that are happening throughout the Pacific, right? Because if you look at that time period, a lot of countries are Solomon Islands gets its independence back. Like all of these, there's a lot of decolonization going on, you know, like in the most literal sense. And then when we see again, like, you know, after like there's the war on drugs and the Reagan years and all these other things, you see Honani K coming out of college, coming back to Hawaii, right? She's very involved with Kalahui, right? Like there's this Hawaiian Renaissance happening again in the 90s, right? I'm in my early 20s. I'm like, what's going on in Hawaii, right? And again, she's like, our struggle is linked to Palestine. Our struggle is linked to East Timor. Our struggle is, you know, she has this whole list. And she names Black liberation struggles. So we, and everybody starts reading Ngugi wa Thiong'o, right? Mm-hmm. There are Black texts that are key to Hawaiian syllabi, right? So like Hawaiians are consistently reading, looking toward Black liberation struggle. Like, quite frankly, like when you look at the kickoff of anything, there's always a Black and Indigenous kind of connection every single time.
Right.
Without it having been influenced by all these other different movements is ridiculous, right? The ideas of creating free schools, the idea of, you know, free food, right? Or a breakfast program, or like having free clinics. That's all coming out of Black liberation, mm-hmm. right? We want to pretend like it's coming from hippies or good, you know, whatever. No.
Yeah.
Seriously, right? And even now you see how much Movement for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter is informed by the 10-point plan of Black Panthers, which was informed by Mao's 10-point plan, right? Mm-hmm. Little Red Book. There's all these different things. We're afraid to say things like socialism. We're afraid to say things. We can say, like, people are willing to say anti-capitalism, but they won't say other, they won't say other things because they're afraid of being red baited. And that's how much work neoliberals have done to actually undermine our movement, mm-hmm. because we're afraid to say things because we're afraid of the repercussions. Right. And so for me, I have to always be like, okay, what would Audre Lorde say? Mm-hmm. Like, you have to speak anyway. Mm-hmm. Right. You can be afraid, but you have to do it anyway.
That's a perfect transition. Thinking about, you know, not just anti-capitalist, but standing for something else, and like moving into this space where we're not just fighting against things, but fighting for things. You said in your speech at the Capitol at the Black Lives Matter rally, genuine security means defund the police. Genuine security means cancel RIMPAC. Genuine security means we do not desecrate the sacred. It means kukia I mauna. And you said it means that we build pu'uhonua within each other. So both racial justice and environmental justice demand that kind of genuine security. Part of this podcast too is thinking about remedies to these problems. So what does genuine security look like for you, and how do we get there?
So genuine security for me looks like we begin investing in those values that we, like aloha aina values, meaning not just investing, you know, we say education, but in a Hawaiian place-based education, right? Because the DOE already had a lot of problems. I don't want to just throw money at the DOE and it's still going to continue to like deny our histories, right, and whatever, but like a Hawaiian place-based, ololo-based education that's really rooted in our history and in our liberation. Genuine security looks like everyone having housing, mm-hmm. is putting funding into housing, not for the rich, but for everyday people that live here, that have built this place, that are from this place, right? From this place first, the descendants of this land, right? It also looks like free healthcare, right? It looks like us taking the money that, you know, rather than giving $40 million to the Department of Defense in the middle of COVID, mm-hmm. so they can have high numbers of COVID and not tell us, take that $40 million that was given to you and earmark it for an improved healthcare system, right? So that everyone gets free healthcare. It means debt forgiveness, right? It means making rents reasonable, right? Or creating community type housing, right? There's so many different ways. We haven't even been allowed to imagine what not having poverty, what having an equal society even could look like. So taking our money and putting it in the places that we say we want it, that we say we care about. Even, you know, even the chief of police is saying like, well, we would love to have more social workers. But what she's talking about is a militarized social workforce, when we could have more social workers and fewer police, and or no police. what does true accountability look like? I want to have funding that goes into helping us really thinking about what does a community-based accountability look like?
Mm.
How do we address rape? How do we address it? And, you know, because right now, women that are raped are not turning to the police for help.
Exactly.
In fact, the police tend to make it worse. Mm-hmm. So when people want to throw these kinds of things up at us, right? I mean, murder, quite frankly, on the part of citizens is probably 1%, if that much, of overall violence. That, you know, and when you really look at what police are responding to, it's usually a drug-related call, right? Or a stolen vehicle or some other kind of property-related crime. But what they're going to hold up is the most extreme cases, right? And many times those most extreme cases are not necessarily happening by Kanaka or people of color, right? But those are the ones that they want to throw at our face. But we need to think about what are the alternatives to a carceral state. So when I think about genuine security, when you end poverty, you get real secure.
Right.
Like violence goes up, domestic violence goes up, theft goes up, all these, when people are insecure financially. And I'm not talking about like everybody needs to have a great capitalist job. No, I'm talking about a collective investment in what the government spends its money in, right? So if we had free healthcare, wow, like imagine how much money that frees up for the rest of us. If we actually put our taxes, if we actually put all of this earmarked money for other, for ridiculous things like the police and actually put it into healthcare, you could have a healthier population. A healthier population is more productive. People forget that when you're healthy and happy and secure, you're actually a more productive worker, mm-hmm. right? It's thinking about labor in these kinds of ways, that workers are actually what run this place and not the bosses, right? So it's helping us get the imagination, you know, and which is, you know, so being an artist, like I spend my time imagining what is the world I want to see, right? It's putting out a sort of, you know, a 21st century imagination around what economy is supposed to look like, right? And so that's what I think about when I think about genuine security. You know, it's there's no need for endless war, which is what the U.S. has been invested in since its inception, right? Since it was before it was the U.S., since it was colonies, since it first arrived here, right? I mean, before, when it first arrived in the East Coast or in, right? We need an end to endless wars. We've only ever known war. And people think that we've had these weird periods of peace. And I'm like, actually, we haven't.
Yeah.
Right? Because there was whether they were at war with Britain or with Spain or with France, or whether it was the Indian Wars or whether it was Mexican, right? Mexican Indian Wars, or whether it's the Korean War, or whether it's World War One, or it's World War Two. There's Iraq. There's, you know, like there's just Afghanistan. There's this constant barrage of conflict.
Yeah,
that's tied to the United States. Now, maybe we don't. They don't always see it on the continent of the United States, but we're in the middle of a civil war right now with the National Guard, right? Who are they sending to these things, right? When people go to protest with no weapon, like with hands up, no weapons. They send the National Guard with tear gas.
Yeah.
If that's not a war with your own people, I don't know what is. That's saying that they're not, that's actually them saying you're not a citizen. Even though, and what I used to love about the Black Panthers is that they would always hold up, the Constitution actually says that if you have a despot in office, it is our obligation to remove them and change the government.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't even read their own Constitution, right? So it's like this constant, like making exceptions to their own laws. I don't even know. And then, but when to throw the law in our face.
Right.
Right. So, genuine security, I'm like, keep, you know, it really looks like we need to put money in different places and we need to think about, like thinking about economy in a totally different way.
I think like because I just watched the speech yesterday and you said at the end, like, it means we never allow the state to tell us what peace looks like. And I feel like what you're saying about imagination is exactly that. Like, we've let them tell us, not just command us, but like they let us tell us in our minds what we're even allowed to imagine for ourselves.
They've done a good job. A good job.
I know, right? It's hard.
Like, so I'm trying to unlearn white supremacy and kind of tell the cop in my head to go away all the time. It's like, why won't I go out? You know, like, I can't stand the 4th of July, but why won't I go out there? Because I don't know what kind of nut job is waiting to hurt me for opposing it, even though I'm in my own country, right? Yeah. It's that kind of self-protection or self-policing that you do, right? Which is why you don't see the level of riots, right, that you will see in other places, because people are so, they have so many cops in their own head. Mm. We're not like that. We're not like that. Mm. I'm like, yeah, we are, actually. We're totally like that. But we know that, I mean, but the thing is, like, we're on an island, you know? And like, so there's always that, who's going to care about us?
Yeah. Right?
Who's going to care, you know what I mean? People always imagine Hawaii as a place for healing or vacation and not as a site of struggle.
Yeah.
And people really have to get over that. I have this fight with activists all the time. I'm like, don't come here for your vacation. Come here and join the fight with me. Yeah. Right. Don't be like, how can we go as a non-tourist? Like, how can we visit without being tourists? I'm like, well, unless you're coming here to do some work, unless you're coming here to hold a sign or to like actually do an action in the street with me,
yeah,
then I don't need you to come visit. Right. And that's exactly what Haunani Kei was trying to get at. Right. When she was saying like flights leave every day, you know, it's not to say that we're not in solidarity with you or not to even come here. But if you're going to come here, you have a kuleana to actually stand and struggle with us.
Mm.
Otherwise, you can stay home.
Yeah.
You know, so those are the kinds of things that I'm sure a lot of people are going to have a difficult time hearing. Sure. I'm going to make a lot of people angry with that statement, but you know.
Awesome. Oh, that was all I had. Is there anything you want to add?
No, I'm sure. I mean, we could talk about this for hours.
I know.
I'm
it sure. was so fun, actually.
I would just say for people to really take the time to learn about the connections that Hawaii has with other liberation struggles, like a real history, like really taking the time to study that, and not just trust what's on the news and to really do your own independent research. Like a lot of these things I learned because I hunted them down to find out. And that's including even Hawaiian resources, you know, Hawaiian newspapers and things like that. You know, there are stories out there that you're like, what? There is that solidarity and that solidarity. But there's also violences that happen within Hawaii that we've forgotten about, right? Yeah. There was a lynching that happened during the kingdom, you know, by a Southern white guy who was running a sugar plantation on Hawaii Island, you know, of a Japanese man who was trying to help his laborers, right? So again, he's killing someone. These guys, you know, killed someone because they were trying to protect workers to protect around their property, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, so I just want really people to really think about who police are. And even though that might be your cousin or whatever, their role is to protect a property, you know? And can we think about different ways, a different job for them, basically, you know? But yeah, that's it for me, I think.
Thank you so much.
Okay, it was a lot.
Nice hearing. It was a lot, but you have done a lot. And it was so nice getting to learn a little bit more about it. Okay, that was a lot to digest, but I love, love, love how Joy makes the personal political, and she helps us to see how we can draw from our own lives and our own experiences to make sense of oppression and to find the power to fight for our collective liberation. Talking to her always reminds me that if we're talking about a single issue, we're just really not digging deep enough to find all those intersections and connections, yeah? Like, environmental justice demands racial justice, and in order to achieve any real justice, movements of all kinds need to work in radical solidarity to reshape our world. Thanks again to Joy for taking the time to share her story, and thanks to all of you for joining us. Stay rooted.